the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, it's expected flooding in northwest Queensland will lead to significant livestock losses in the cattle industry. It's too early to say how much, but we're certainly watching that here on the program today. But first up today, let's turn our attention to state politics, because the state Liberals will be relying on some familiar but also some new faces for the shadow cabinet that was unveiled yesterday. Amongst party leader Kelly Sloan's new look cabinet is Northern Tablelands Nationals MP Brendan Moylan, who was appointed the Agriculture and Regional Crime Prevention's portfolios. The former solicitor was elected to the seat of the Northern Tablelands just 18 months ago. Here's the New South Wales Nationals leader Gurmesh Singh talking about that appointment.
And Brendan Moylan from the Northern Tablelands, he knows more about agriculture than just about anyone else in Parliament, and especially from a legal perspective. And, you know, his experience dealing in the legal system as a solicitor in the bush means he's got a great deal of experience in the justice system as well. And that's why we've given him those two portfolios with agriculture and the prevention of regional crime, because, you know, we know that it's much more complicated than just policing. This is looking at the justice system as a whole. And, you know, that's why we're really excited to have someone of Brendan's calibre join us, our shadow cabinet, bringing his wealth of experience with him.
Now, the ABC's James Parris spoke with Brendan Moylan about his reaction to the appointment and his goals for agriculture.
Look, it happened really quickly, James. I received a phone call yesterday afternoon from the New South Wales Nats leader, Gurmesh, who advised me that I'd been appointed as Shadow Ag Minister and Shadow Prevention of Regional Crime Minister as well. So it's moved very quickly. I'm down in Parliament now for a few commitments, and then hopefully get home tomorrow back to the family to enjoy what's left of the break. So, yeah, moving very quickly.
We'll get into the portfolios in just a second, but I'm just wondering if you've taken some time to reflect on your own journey. Obviously, only been in the state MP role for approaching 2 years now. You know, did you ever expect this to kind of come along so quick?
No. It's roughly a year and a half since I became the member for Northern Tablelands. So no, I certainly did not expect to be appointed into the shadow ministry. It was something I, you know, was hopeful of at some point, but certainly not at this time. But look, the portfolios that I have as well really enable me to continue to do, you know, a lot of work in the electorate, as much work as what I've been doing, because both ag and regional crime are obviously both, you know, fundamental to the Northern Tablelands electorate. So it's a good fit.
Yeah, let's start with regional crime prevention. Obviously, something you've been incredibly outspoken about, and you've done a lot of liaising with the state government. What does this allow you to do now?
Look, it's more of the same. I've tried to take the approach with the Attorney General of trying to be as bipartisan as I can to address the issues that our, you know, regional towns, particularly in the Northern Tablelands, are facing. And so it'll be a continuation of that. I think what we need to look at as well is whether the taxpayer money that we're spending on programs in the regions to combat regional crime, I think we need to look at whether they're working or not, and whether we're getting, you know, bang for buck, so to speak, in terms of all of that money that's going into that issue. Touch wood, James, it's been a pretty good summer so far in terms of regional crime in the Northern Tablelands, which is good. You know, our police are doing good work, but this new position allows me, I suppose, to continue working with the Attorney General, working with the Parliamentary Secretary, to make sure that regional crime is an issue that remains on the government's agenda.
Also, the backbone of our region and most of regional New South Wales is agriculture. What's your kind of goals and ambitions there?
Yeah, look, first things first, I'll be making a few phone calls today to, you know, a number of stakeholders, such as New South Wales farmers, but also farmers that I know and, you know, have worked for on their farms over the years, just to get a bit of an idea as to the, you know, the key issues that ag's facing. I've got a pretty good handle on it, but I believe that for the You know, for me to be an effective shadow minister, I have to work right across the industry, and that's what I'm going to start doing today. And pretty much after this, I'll be giving Xavier Martin at New South Wales Farmers call to have a chat.
We've often heard from our local MPs and I guess a lot of people in the Liberal and Nationals Party about being in the shadow ministry and how it can be difficult to get things done. How are you feeling about this new shadow cabinet and I guess its ability to maybe return to power and more importantly, get stuff done?
Yeah, we've got 430 days until the next state election. And so with the appointment today, I think we've got a good team, James. We've got a mixture of experience. We've got new MPs like myself that have, you know, life experience outside of politics, which is really important. So I think it will be a process of working, you know, very hard with the key stakeholders, working across that political divide with the government, because at the end of the day, we're all sent down to Sydney, to state parliament, to do a job for our electorates. So whether we are shadow ministers, whether we're ministers, whether we're local members, well, I mean, we're all local members at the end of the day, and that's our job. That's what we're sent down here to do. And so it's nice to be given that trust by leadership. I'm looking forward to getting on with it and getting into it. But at the end of the day, my fundamental job remains as the member for Northern Tablelands. And as I said, these two portfolios work in really well with my electorate.
For your voters in the electorate of the Northern Tablelands, will they see any changes in your day-to-day from now on?
No, it'll still be 6 days in the electorate when we're not sitting. You know, the shadow work, the policy development work, most of that's done, to be fair, after hours at night. So no, there won't be any noticeable change. I'll still be on the road 6 days a week, James, and have Sundays at home.
Northern Tablelands Nationals MP Brendan Moylan speaking there to James Parris about his appointment to the Shadow Cabinet in New South Wales. It's coming up to 12 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
It's expected that the flooding in northwest Queensland will lead to significant livestock losses in the cattle industry, but there's hope they won't be as significant as the 2019 floods, which killed an estimated 450,000 animals. The flooding comes at a time when producers and processors need to navigate a new export hurdle to China as well. Simon Quilty is meat and livestock analyst and consultant with Global Agri Trends, and he spoke with Barbara Miller about how the losses could impact our national herd.
Barbara, they are in the vicinity of 19 to 20,000 head so far as we can gather. It's very localised and very different to that January 2019 flood, which was far more widespread. And the losses, as you said, were greater than 450,000. The one area that's particularly badly hit at the moment is Flinders River. And at the moment at Normanton, it's 16 metres high, just below the 2019 record level of 17.1. The real impact here, Barbara, is after the floods recede, the floodwaters, because the concern with hypothermia is that a lot of these animals, this is a breeding area, so calves and cows, could die due to hypothermia and could take the losses, I believe, to potentially greater than 50,000.
And what about the rain? Is that in any way good? Is there any upside?
Yes, there is, Barbara. So here we have a situation where Queensland for the last 2.5 years has been in a holding pattern in terms of whether rebuilding or liquidating, whereas Southern Australia we've seen a very heavy liquidation occur. This rainfall, given how widespread across northern and central Queensland, I think could be the trigger to seeing a rebuild commence in northern Australia, driven by both good rains, good pastures, and good prices that have come from the south.
And as we said there, Simon, this comes as China has announced new tariffs once Australia exceeds a quota for its beef exports. How big a hurdle is this going to be for the industry?
There is no doubt this is a challenge, and we've now been set a safeguard, which is the level at which we get to in terms of beef exports at 205,000 metric tonnes. Where it gets challenging for us, Barbara, is that in the past we have had safeguards before, but the tariff, once you reach that level, was 12%. Today, that's 55%, and it's cost prohibitive, and we'll see the flow of beef stop into China as a result.
What does it mean, though, that they, you know, once this tariff kicks in, once a certain level of export has been reached, does that, you know, how does that affect the industry over the course of a year?
Well, what happens is that we have many programs in place for high quality beef, whether it's chilled or frozen, and that requires sending consistently product every month to meet the requirements of customers and consumers across China. So when you suddenly introduce this, and it's likely to be filled by probably late April, early May, because of the rush to the door effect, because everyone will try to get in before the trigger is, before the safeguard is triggered. Therefore, that beef flow stops because you suddenly hit 55% very early in the year, and the market will be devoid of meat for the balance of the year.
Are you getting a sense that producers are already looking to alternative markets after this announcement from Beijing?
Possibly, but the problem is, Barbara, that every other supply country into China has been subjected with the same safeguard and the same very high preventative tariffs. In some instances, it's as high as 67%. So the problem is that everyone rushes from all these other countries to fill their safeguard or quota access into China. We all fill it in April, May, and we all look for alternate markets at the same time. I estimate, based on 2025 figures, that this could be as high as 550,000 metric tons at the same time trying to seek other markets globally. That leads to downward pressure on pricing. So, Barbara, we think there's a way forward here, though, a better solution for Australia to try and avoid this problem.
Simon Quilty is a meat and livestock analyst with Global Agri Trends, and he was speaking there with Barbara Miller.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmental and the odd Black Angus.
The Country Hour.
It's a bit of a fruit salad.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Food of the gods.
On ABC Radio.
Well, let's turn our attention to the gun laws now, because New South Wales Greens MP Sue Higginson says a new limit of 10 guns for primary producers is adequate, despite calls from farmers that it's not enough. Under new state government reforms, individuals with a gun licence are limited to 4 firearms and primary producers are allowed up to 10. Farming bodies say multiple guns are required for different purposes, such as animal welfare, pest management and sport shooting. But Ms Higginson, New South Wales Greens MP and spokesperson for agriculture, told Lauren Bohane the cases requiring more than 10 guns are actually just niche circumstances.
Look, at this point, I really haven't seen the kind of the actual evidence case for that submission that the cap of 10 should be lifted. That's 10 is a lot of guns. Like, that is a lot of firearms in one single person's possession. And at this point in time, that limit, I think, at this point, is a really reasonable limit. And I think that limit should stay as it is.
The argument, I suppose, is that they need different guns for different purposes, that a lot of farmers are operating across multiple properties. So if they only have a certain number of guns, that will mean they have to be racked and transported. Some farmers are also, you know, sporting shooters, so they've got different guns for that. I suppose those are the key arguments. What's your response to those?
Yeah, look, I think that at this point in time, the limit is the limit. I mean, what the state is saying is that, look, 10 guns is what the state has determined is the reasonable cap on firearms. Now, if you are a rural land holder and you require those 10 guns, then you require those 10 guns. At the moment, the cap or the limit for anyone who's not a rural land holder or doesn't fall into another exemption category is, in fact, 4 firearms. So, you know, the fact that the law may have been different prior to this does not mean now that we should be working carve-outs and workarounds for those really kind of on-the-edge and fringe exemptions that are being called for. The fact of the matter is, this is about safety. It's about laws that are of a blanket application. They're never going to satisfy every single individual. I'm a farmer. We know the need and use of firearms in our land management programs. I also have many constituents out there that are rural landholders and managing large tracts of land. I know that for some this will be an inconvenience. I realise that there will be a need to change practice slightly. But the reality is 10 guns, 10 firearms is a lot of firearms for one person, and it's enough in order to manage land. If you have too many farms and too much country, and that becomes an inconvenience in terms of how many firearms, then, you know, just look at how you're managing that country. Look at how you might be able to change your practice slightly. Look at who's your land manager and whether they have firearms licenses and so forth. There are ways to work around this.
Just quickly on that buyback scheme, you know, some farmers have said they've got guns worth, you know, thousands of dollars. I mean, is there a way that that could be addressed? Would more farmers be on board if they felt they were going to get properly compensated through the buyback scheme?
Look, I think that's a possibility. And I think that, yeah, if there is scope for more discussion around how the buyback scheme will commence and roll out, I think that the government should have open ears about that. Because at the end of the day, this really shouldn't be about the money. It really shouldn't be about the money. There are millions of dollars here for this program. If it is a matter of a few hundred extra thousand dollars here or there to satisfy people and bring them on board, then absolutely we should be doing that. Look, if people are really concerned that they will get, for want of a better term, ripped off through the buyback scheme, we should be looking at that, because nobody should be getting ripped off for doing the right thing and all walking forward together.
New South Wales Greens MP and spokesperson for agriculture, Sue Higginson, speaking there to Lauren Bohane.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
We're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Well, to the season now and to grain news, and for most of the south of the state, harvest was wrapped up just in time for Christmas, and there are a few farmers around who are pretty happy with the results, although there have been some that missed out completely. And Emily Middleton caught up with the National Operations Manager of GrainCorp, Jason Stanley, and asked him what he's seen across New South Wales.
If I start with the Dubbo, what we call our Dubbo West Cluster, which kind of covers Narromine, Nevatai, Ningen, Tottenham, Trangie, out in those areas. So took a bit over 500,000 tonnes across there. From a quality perspective, yeah, really, really good. The vast majority of grain, particularly with wheat, fell into the milling grades. Some screenings issues, you know, for the minor tonnages that fell into some off grades, just around screenings, which, you know, comes off the back of a fairly dry finish to the season out there. Similar for the rest of southern New South Wales. So look, we've still got a little bit of grain coming in, just trickling in across the probably Junee, Tamora, Cunningar areas. But by and large, it's done and was mostly done before Christmas as well. So just shy of hitting 2 million tonnes across that southern New South Wales area. Again, from a quality perspective, you know, probably 90% or more of the wheat fell into milling grades there, and anything that didn't fall into milling grades, again, was just a result of that dry finish with some higher screenings in some areas. But all in all, not a bad result. From our perspective, across those regions, very much working through having grain locked down, fumigated, and got a large outturn program underway at the moment. So things are very much switched into moving grain from sites out to our customers, both domestically and international.
How does that compare to previous years, the amount of tonnes that's come off?
Pretty similar to the previous year. You know, probably around that Griffith area and Junee were probably a bit down on tonnes. I think if you recall last year, particularly out in that Griffith area, we had some frost events in the previous harvest which dropped the tonnage back. We escaped those types of issues this year, but more that the dry season just reduced tonnes there. So all in all, across southern New South Wales, very similar tonnages to the previous season.
Winter crops will be going in a few weeks or a few months' time. How is that looking? How's the ground looking for that to go in?
I think everyone will be hoping for some decent rainfall over the next couple of months. Obviously, a few hot days ahead as well across the region, so that's going to dry things out. So I think everyone will be hoping for some decent rainfall across that February, March, April period.
That's the National Operations Manager for GrainCorp, Jason Shanley. Well, to the northwest now, where farmers and agronomists describe the season so far as a bit of a storm lotto. Patchy storms have seen some farms receive up to 100 millimetres, while unlucky neighbours have been hit with hail and little moisture. Lara Webster spoke to Walgett agronomist Peter Meppam about how the start of 2026 is shaping up for this cropping season.
Yeah, not too bad, Lara. We had a little bit of rain sort of pre-Christmas, which was an early Christmas gift for a few people around the place, and then sort of followed up, you know, in the last sort of week by these few storms. It's definitely still storm lotto around the place, you know, and some people are sort of still around that sort of 40 or 50 mils for the last sort of 60 to 90 days, whereas some are up over 150 mils in places.
Yeah, so definitely, Patchy, you mentioned those areas that haven't seen a whole lot of rain, maybe 40 to 50 mils in the last few months. How are crops in those patches faring at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose in the Walga district as a whole, we don't have a lot of summer crop in because the winter season was so good to us and a lot of people didn't leave much fallow out. But there is a little bit of sorghum and a little bit of dryland cotton in around the place. And fortunately enough, particularly on the blocks that we are looking at, the rain has fallen on those dryland cotton blocks, and they're off to a promising start, and they look really good. The sorghum blocks around the place, they probably tell a bit of a different story. They sit in sort of both areas, both the good and the bad, and there's sort of some stuff there that should be pushing ahead out now, and it's sort of stuck in the boot just to limited rainfall around the place.
How are things shaping up though for planting the next lot of crops? I imagine you do need quite a bit more moisture yet.
We do, and I suppose, you know, that comes down to crop rotation as well. You know, we're starting to build a profile on anything that's sort of coming out of, say, legume crops, or, you know, particularly the faba bean crops, where we know the moisture's, you know, not too bad down low, so they don't take as long to fill as the big cereal crops that we've just pulled off. So we're starting to sort of push a probe in around the place, and we are finding where we're getting that, you know, 90 to 150 mils, we're starting to get a bit of a profile. But, you know, there are still areas that are still way down. And so we're looking forward to a lot more rain yet before planting comes.
Well, there may not be too many summer crops around Walgett. At Narrabri, it looks like cotton's shaping up to be a cracker if more rain comes down. Matt Norrie is a grower just outside Narrabri, and he says his crops are faring well so far.
Look, it's all progressing very nicely, Lara. We're coming up to our third in-crop irrigation. The crop's getting into flowering. It's really starting to hit its straps, and it's all looking reasonably good so far.
What about the rest of the district? What are you sort of hearing from friends and neighbours?
There's been a bit of storm lotto around. Some guys have got under some good falls in patches. Some other guys through November, there was some hail around. So there's been a little bit of hail activity, which has knocked some crops around. But generally, things are progressing. There's some pretty nice sorghum crops about the place as well. And the dryland cotton's all progressing okay as well. But really, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, that dryland cotton's going to want to get under a good fall of rain here somewhere if it's going to reach its potential.
Well, that was my next question, the ideal scenario really from here on in, because as you say, that we have had that storm lottery. Some people are under the right cloud, some people are under the wrong one with that hail, and some people aren't under a cloud. So what's the ideal situation from here?
If we could put an order in for about 50 mils of rain every 3 weeks for the next 3 months, that would be ideal. So I'll put the order in now. I just need to go to church to make it happen.
Yeah. Look, I'll try on the rural report, but you never know. Miracles have happened, Matt Norrie. As you say, that's the ideal scenario. I mean, how much potential is there for this crop at the moment?
It's looking really good, Lara. We had some cooler temperatures through November, which I thought might have flared a little bit of verticillium in the cotton early, but we seem to come out of that okay. So the crop's looking really, really good. It's setting itself up for some really good potential. Water availability this season for most is really good for the irrigated cotton. And, if we could just keep these temperatures in the Goldilocks zone, which is below 40, during the day and above 20 at night, this crop's got some really, really good potential at this point.
That's Narrabri cotton grower Matt Norrie speaking there with Lara Webster, and we also heard from Walgett agronomist Peter Meppam. We're talking about the weather and what they're hoping for in terms of cropping in the next few weeks or so, a bit of rain as well, but that's not likely to happen in the next few days. Joining us now from the Bureau to get a snapshot of the weather is Tristan Samana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour. Now, hot weather is the order of the day for the next few days, really.
Yes, most definitely right. We do currently have a heatwave warning for severe and extreme heatwave conditions across much of the state, particularly across the southern inland, including the Riverina, and then stretching all the way to the south coast. And that is starting from today, which is Wednesday, continuing on into Saturday as well. So definitely quite hot, very hot conditions, with those temperatures possibly reaching into the high 30s along the south coast and into the low to mid 40s if you're in the inland. So yes, definitely very hot. And accompanied with this hot weather is an increase of those fire dangers, with wind starting to increase from the Friday, leading to some widespread high fire dangers and possibly even extremes as we head into Saturday before that cold front and trough starts across the state on the Saturday and will bring that relief that I'm pretty sure we all are pretty much wanting right now.
Yeah, big drop in temperature from that change when it comes through. But before that, though, we're going to see quite high temperatures, and the highest we've seen since 2019 and also a few days in a row.
Yeah, so we definitely see those temperatures rising up into possibly the mid 40s, particularly in the Riverina and the Lower Western for today, and that also could be a case as we head into tomorrow and on Friday and Saturday as well, before that trough starts to come on that Saturday. So yes, definitely very hot, and something that we haven't seen since 2019 to 2020.
Yeah, and talking about that too, there's also concern about extreme fire danger in some of those spots as well, with some gusty winds and that sort of thing. So that could potentially be an issue or a warning that might be coming in the next couple of days or so as well.
Yeah, we may be issuing a warning for those extreme fire dangers, particularly for parts of the southeast and the central east as well. And also with those increasing winds, we may possibly see some strong gusts on Friday and Saturday. And that's also likely to increase those fire dangers again as well. So quite an active day in terms of heat and fires for Friday and Saturday.
And when this change comes through, is there any rain in it?
Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of rain associated with this change coming through. It's just some quite gusty winds, especially along the coast, where we could see a southerly buster come up through the south coast and the Illawarra, potentially even reaching the Sydney metropolitan region as well. So quite a gusty change as opposed to a rain, but we may not be expecting rain or showers with this change. It seems to be quite dry as we head into the weekend.
Okay. And I was going to ask about that. Looking further ahead, is there any scope for any rain after that change at all, or are we sort of going to move back into a warmer pattern again?
Look, we're looking into a more stable weather pattern with sort of an inland trough and then a high in the Tasman, bringing in those coastal showers and possible thunderstorms. But as in terms of the amount of the rainfall, heavier rainfall in the inland, I'd say that there is quite a very low chance that that would be happening. It looks to be like it's remaining particularly dry in the inland as we head into next week.
So, yeah, staying dry, basically, and particularly in the inland. And it may be heating up again?
Look, I don't think there is an indication that it may
too early to tell, maybe, yeah.
But it looks like the temperatures will stay around quite warm, but only in around the low to mid-30s across the inland, and cooler conditions on the coast as well, dropping into the low to mid-20s.
So quite a big change there. Yeah, like a 20-degree drop. Yeah,
it's quite a 20-degree drop, and you may be experiencing that as that subtly change comes through on the Saturday, especially along the coast.
Okay, Tristan, appreciate your time. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Michael. Enjoy your afternoon.
Yes, Tristan Samana at the Bureau there. It's coming up to 25 minutes to one.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the National Farmers Federation has taken aim at a federal inquiry into the value of skilled migration, saying it should also take into account unskilled migration. The inquiry by the Joint Standing Committee on Migration will not consider unskilled migration by groups, including backpackers and also Palm Scheme workers as well. NFF President Hamish McIntyre says that this is a big oversight.
Skilled migrants play a very important supporting role in our agricultural workforce, but we shouldn't, you know, lose sight of the critical importance of semi-skilled workers and unskilled workers play also, Angus, you know, across our regional communities, whether it's our town councils or our shires, our contractors that we work with, you know, farming contractors and earth-moving contractors are all struggling, you know, in the areas of, you know, getting operators to drive trucks and tractors and heavy earth-moving machinery. So it's across our communities that there is a problem. So we just want to highlight the importance of suitable workforce for all roles that we do have in regional Australia. You know, the skilled ones do play an important role in our agronomy areas and, you know, as vets too, and also in biosecurity areas, all those things. Machinery maintenance, particularly mechanics, are very important too, Angus. So it's just getting that right balance that we do need a broad cross-section of people, and also highlight to our governments the importance of funding housing in regional Australia too to support immigrants that come to, you know, do these roles and work in our communities with us and live there and create a life and a home. It's so important that we have suitable accommodation for them.
So is that then an oversight of this inquiry? Because if you read the terms of reference, it only refers to skilled migrants. It doesn't reference those unskilled or semi-skilled workers that you're talking about. Does that mean that they won't be looking at the importance of those people?
We believe so. So that's why we're highlighting it, Angus, that it's so important for our regional communities right across Australia to have those broad cross-section of people we just discussed. So I think it's very important that that government does understand it's probably semi-skilled to a greater extent, of which we are shorter of.
And how much has the importance of those unskilled or semi-skilled workers been on show just in the past couple of months through harvest? Because if you look at a lot of the people who are driving tractors or headers or running grain receival sites, it seems like a very large portion of those were your backpacker-type workers.
Absolutely, Angus, yeah. You know, as we speak today, we have Palm Islanders irrigating cotton for us up here and have plenty of backpackers working with us in our feedlots and operating machinery too. So, look, it's without them, we wouldn't be getting the job done in regional Australia at the moment. So it just highlights that importance. And we really want, you know, policies that enable us to operate sustainably and profitably with the appropriate workforce. So it is critical that government does understand the cross-section of people we need in our communities.
And if I talk from my own experience, where I'm from, Bort in north central Victoria, I know that the grain receival sites there or essentially staffed by a big crew of Argentinian backpackers out doing some pretty tough work out on the bunkers. That's the sort of work that it's pretty hard to convince local people to do, isn't it?
That's right, Angus, and there's plenty of willing backpackers and these Pacific and Island schemes that are very happy to do it and enjoy regional Australia while they're out here. I mean, it's part of tourism for us, and they love getting into our areas and just out of the big cities. It's a very different lifestyle and something they'll always remember. So, you know, in our own business at the moment, I mean, we only have 3 out of 6 trucks moving today because we're down 3 truck drivers and it is just so hard to find drivers with the appropriate licenses, particularly, we rely on MC licenses with our triple trucks bringing cattle in from the Channel Country back into where we background and feedlot them where we are and it's real. So we just want to really express to governments to consider all requirements and please not just focus on the very high-skilled immigration policy people.
Are you worried about potential changes to migration policy and particularly cuts to migration numbers in the future, perhaps at subject to political cycles?
Look, we'll stay out of the politics of it. We do need people in regional Australia, and so it's a case of government understanding what our requirements are. I mean, there are plenty of studies out there showing the shortages, so it's encouraging more of who come to Australia to move to regional Australia, I think, is a critical thing. And as I said, too, providing appropriate accommodation and infrastructure for them in our regional communities. I mean, to be sustainable long-term as farmers and producing food and fibre here, we need really vibrant, you know, regional communities that have a large population and can grow. I mean, you know, we encourage people to hop off their planes and move west if you land in the eastern seaboard, or move north if you land in the southern seaboard, or back to the east if you land in the west. There's more to Australia than our big cities, and the more we encourage immigrants to come out and, for a start, I mean, obviously have a look, and as you were talking about backpackers, but then, you know, if they do decide to move to regional Australia with their families, we have the appropriate facilities for them, you know, including education, hospitals and obviously housing.
In general, do you think Canberra has an appreciation of the importance of these workers to agriculture and regional Australia?
I think they do, but, we do need to keep reminding them. I know politicians from our regional areas all do understand it. It's just, it's a great debate. There seems to be still policies encourage centralisation instead of decentralisation is what we want. If you look at our Northern Hemisphere trading opposition, you know, right across Northern American countries and right across Europe, who we compete with for markets. They have broad populations right throughout their regional areas and have people living all over those countries. Australia's got a lot of areas probably that aren't suitable, but there's still a huge area that it is very suitable that we need to move people back into and have vibrant regional communities.
And the sorts of workers that you were talking about employing, Hamish, what's the attitude from them when they do come to regional Australia and find these sorts of jobs? What sort of attitude do they bring to work?
A great attitude, and it's also very interesting for our families and the people we work with currently. I mean, their cultural differences, the stories they have. You only have to have a beer with an Argentinian backpacker and the stories they tell about home on a Friday night to our people, or you hear them talking about it when they're working irrigating here, different things. See, it's just fascinating. So it's win-win. It's very healthy and it broadens everyone's horizons, I believe.
That was National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre speaking there with Angus Verley about that Joint Standing Committee on Migration not considering unskilled migration by groups including backpackers and palm scheme workers and the NFF president saying that's a big oversight. You're listening to The Country Hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Annie Guest. Join me for The World Today. The United States discussing ways for acquiring Greenland. The White House saying military force is always an option. Most states and territories facing heatwave warnings as temperatures soar in Victoria and South Australia. And all aboard the Elvis train, fans head to the iconic Parkes Elvis Festival. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today at lunchtime.
But here on the Country Hour, well, a tiny songbird species living in pockets of high-altitude rainforest across northeastern New South Wales is having its DNA sequenced in a bid to safeguard the species. The rufous scrubbird is one of the world's oldest surviving songbirds, but scientists believe fewer than 2,000 of them remain after fires decimated their habitat in 2019 and 2020. Senior Threat and Species Officer with the New South Wales Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, Brian Hawkins, told Hannah Ross the DNA project aims to pinpoint the genetic differences between five isolated colonies of the bird.
Rufous scrub birds are very small brown birds with a little bit of rufous or reddish colouring on them. They're almost impossible to see because they live in really, really, really dense understory vegetation. There's not many of them left, maybe 1 to 2,000 left. They occur in five isolated high altitude rainforest areas in old Gondwanan type forests in northeast New South Wales, and they just creep into southeast Queensland as well. Often you can be within a meter or two of a calling male and you just can't see them. Fortunately, although they're nearly impossible to see and even harder to catch, they're very, very, very easy to hear. They have an incredible song. It's incredibly loud and powerful and rich. And like their closest relatives, the lyrebirds, they're really good mimics. They're really playful. So they will sometimes seem to play with other species of birds by mimicking them. They're really smart. They're evolutionarily, the two remaining species of scrub birds, the rufous scrub bird, which is the one that we have in the subtropics of eastern Australia, and the noisy scrub bird, which is just hanging on in southwest Western Australia. Evolutionarily, the scrub birds are really special because they're the closest living relatives of the ancestral songbirds that evolved in Australia more than 30 million years ago. Anywhere you go in the world now, except maybe Antarctica, you'll hear beautiful, rich birdsong from songbirds, which since they evolved in Australia all those years ago have radiated all the way across the world and just bring so much joy and pleasure to so many people with their beautiful songs.
You know this ancestral lineage because you've been doing some DNA testing on this little bird.
The aim of this project was to get DNA from scrub birds, to get really high quality DNA, which has never been done before. And part of the reason for that is that they are almost impossible to catch. They are really shy of going into a net. And even when they do fly into a net, they're so agile that they can get out almost straight away. But we wanted to get DNA from them so that we can have a look at their conservation genetics. The way things stand at the moment, rufous scrub birds are split into two subspecies. There's a northern subspecies and a southern subspecies. And that's mainly based on differences in their songs. But we really need to get DNA from the birds to confirm whether they are actually two different subspecies or a single subspecies or two different species or five subspecies, or really to get the most fundamental information about the different populations of the bird, which is essential for any future management. For example, if it turned out that they were all one subspecies and the next time that there's a massive bushfire roaring towards rufous scrub bird habitat, like happened in the Black Summer fires in 2019 and 2020, if we wanted to try and go out and rescue birds and take them into captivity to start a captive breeding program, we could do that in the knowledge that we could breed the northern birds and the southern birds together, and it wouldn't be a big deal. We wouldn't be compromising the identity of the species. But if, on the other hand, it turns out that there are really important genetic differences between the different populations, then we would want to be really careful about mixing the different populations together in captivity.
What's the process of trying to gather the DNA like?
Initially, we had a go in the spring of 2024, but we weren't able to catch any birds. So we came back this spring in August with a team led by researchers from ANU, but also featuring staff from the New South Wales Environment Department and New South Wales National Parks. And we went out to Werribee National Park. The male scrub birds, they have these really small singing territories of about a hectare in size. And in that hectare, they spend most of their time in a central area that's much smaller than a hectare. And they just sing, like in the breeding season in the spring, they just sing like all day long pretty much. But they're widely separated from each other. So you might have a singing territory and the next closest singing territory might be a kilometre away. So they're really quite dispersed. So you go up into the rainforest mountains where they live and you find a singing territory, and we already knew where there were some really good singing territories close to roads up in Werribee, and you make a recording of the song of that male bird, and then you set up a mist net in the rainforest or in the scrub, and you try and get the male bird to come into the mist net, which is pretty much like a very fine mesh fishing net that you set up between two poles in the forest, and that goes from about 2 meters above the ground right down to ground level. And then you try and attract the male towards the mist net by playing back his own calls from a little UE boom that you hide in the bushes, and you have one on each side of the mist net. And then if you're really lucky, he will think that there's a male bird challenging his territory, and he'll dash into the mist net, and you have probably a fraction of a second to grab him before he disentangles himself from the mist net.
That's the Senior Threatened Species Officer with the New South Wales Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water, Brian Hawkins, talking there to Hannah Ross about the tiny songbird, the rufous scrub bird. You're listening to The Country Hour. Before we head to market information, let's look at what's happening in the weaner sales. Just over 7,000 head of young black Angus cattle were sold at the Northern Victoria Livestock Exchange just outside of Wodonga yesterday. It was pretty hot inside the yards, even under the tin roof. One of the top-selling pens came from Talangatta, a vendor, Lang, with 309-kilogram weaner steers selling for $5.79 a kilogram, or $1,790 a head. Andy Brown caught up with Megan Peterkin at the sale yards for a bit of a chat.
Yeah, my name's Megan, and I'm looking after my dad's farm, who passed away a couple of years ago. He primarily used to fatten steers into bullocks, and a few years before he died at the age of, 90-odd, swapped over to cows and calves. He always wanted us kids to get, thought we'd be better off getting to cows and calves. So we got into cows and calves, and we're just in a stage now of building up our numbers of, Angus cattle, cows and calves, yeah.
Whereabouts do you farm?
Just the other side of Talangatta, old Talangatta, yes, George's Creek, yes.
And tell me a bit about how the sale went today here at NVLX. So big day for the weaner calf sales, and it sounds like one of your pens got one of the top prices.
Yeah, it was a very good sale. We're very happy with the results today. Cattle weighed well, they penned up well, and I think overall most people would be pretty happy. Like, people were a bit worried about what's going on overseas sometimes, but look, it is what it is, and it's good to get the cattle here, sell them, and then you just start the process again. So you just have to go with the flow, don't you?
So a good start to the new year.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about what the season's been like just outside Talangatta around your way.
Yeah, we didn't have much of an autumn the last 2 years, so winter was pretty tough, and we sort of had to feed a few cows and they got through all right. But the spring was quite good, actually. We've got good feed. We're grass-fed.
And yeah, we've still got a bit of a green pick on the creek flats, and so spring was good. We weaned our calves early-ish, end of October, early November. So if the season went off, we could then sell the calves a bit earlier if we needed to, but it was fine. We've had not a bad spring, so we heads kept them for this sale and sold them today.
Yeah. I guess in terms of these sales, it kicks off the year. Do you find this is also a bit of a test of where the market's at and how things are going at the moment?
It's probably a bit of a benchmark, yeah. It probably just starts sort of sets a bit of a mark for the sales going forward over the next couple of weeks, I assume. Yeah, they probably would, I think. And yeah.
Do you have any more cattle to sell, or is this today?
We've got a few more left over to sell. We kept quite a few heifers this year to try and build up our... We kept nearly 100 heifers to try and build up our numbers a bit more. So just a few odds and ends to sell now, but this is pretty much it, yes, yeah.
And so you trade under the name Lang after your father, yeah, that you mentioned at the top. Tell us a bit about your father, Lang. Who was he and what was he known for?
He was in the business all his life. I think he started when he was about 16 with Gippsland and Northern, and he died at 95, and he was still tangled up with Corcoran and Parker. He was still, he'd still get, you know, buy cattle for people and sell for people, you know, help organise cattle. Still buying bulls, you know, at a bull sale a couple of months before he died, and... No, he was very involved, and still, up until he died, he was still running the farm. You know, I was helping him, but he made all the decisions.
That's Megan Peterkin talking about her late father, Lang Peterkin, and she was talking there to Annie Brown at the Wodonga Sale Yards. Talking about sale yards, let's go to markets. First up, casino cattle.
Good afternoon. There was just 575 head yarded for the first sale of the year, consisting mainly of weaner cattle and cows. Quality was mixed in a market that saw restock of weaner steers sell 40 cents cheaper compared to last year's sale, mainly due to limited buyer attendance. They sold from 398 to 520. Restock of weaner heifers were back by 12 cents, 360 to 416. Restock of yearling steers topped at 470 cents. Cows were 10 to 15 cents dearer. Two score medium weights, 320 to 360. Three scores averaged 367 cents. And heavy cows sold from 368 to 405 cents. Doug Robson at Casino.
To singleton cattle now.
Good afternoon. Singleton agents yarded a healthy 954 cattle for the first sale back. Quality was good, and the market was on song from the word go. Light restocker steer calves trading 38 cents a kilo dearer, making from 418 to 556 and averaging around 507. Medium and heavyweight sold to firm trends, and they made from 448 to 536. Light heifer calves 40 cents a kilo dearer, 380 to 440 and averaging 411. Prime supplementary fed euro calves to the local trade saw big bidding duels, and they sold from 522 to 544. Medium and heavyweight yearling steers to both background and feed saw little discrimination on breed type to be 16 cents a kilo dearer and more in places, and they made from 436 to 488. The odd grown steer, heifer and bullock sold from 410 to 446. Around 200 cows off at the market started with a bang, which saw lighter two scores improved by 16 cents a kilo, selling from 220 to 370. Three and four scores were much dearer in places, and they made from 364 to 436 cents a kilo. Angus Barlow for MLA at Singleton.
Let's go to Carcor sheep and lambs now.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers remained steady for 3,500. Quality was mixed with some well-finished shorn lambs, along with the secondary grades throughout. There were mainly trades penned, a few heavies, stores were in reasonable numbers. Medium and heavy trades were firm to 5 cheaper. 20 to 22 kilos sold from 220 to 255. 22 to 24, 236 to 265, averaging 1,050 to 1,100 cents. Heavy weights were firm, 26 plus, 312 to a top of 336, averaging 1,050 to 1,140 cents. Stores sold from 145 to 227. There was 1,600 mutton, quality varied, prices were dearer. Heavy merino ewes 180 to 210, averaging 725 cents. Heavy first cross ewes 202 to 270, averaging 750 to 805 cents. And this has been Rob Pearce from MLA at Carcor.
And that's the market information for today. You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.